the case will be taken under advisement. We'll move to the second case of the morning, which is Fairfax Nursing Home against the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Dufour.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I would like to first address the administrative law judge's error regarding the burden of proof. The standard of review for this issue is de novo. The ALJ below placed the ultimate burden of proof on Fairfax by following an earlier administrative decision called Hillman. And as you know from the briefs, we've challenged Hillman on three grounds. First, that Hillman conflicts with Section 7C of the APA. Second, that it is a substantive rule that has never been promulgated through the notice and comment provisions of the APA. And third, that Hillman conflicts with the Secretary's own regulations regarding CMP hearings.
Why does this make any difference in the, given the fact that the ALJ, whatever he may have said before he got to it, actually winds up finding that the Secretary has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that you're not compliant, you were not, petitioner was not complying substantially with the relevant requirements, and that also the preponderance of the evidence established that the deficiency was at the immediate jeopardy level. Those findings are the best you could have gotten under the exact regulations that you think should have been there.
Your Honor, that's essentially an argument that the error was harmless, that there was sufficient evidence to find
right.
The deficiency.
You're not arguing that the harmless error standard doesn't apply to this kind of case, are you?
No, but I would like to just point out why that error was not harmless and why the burden of proof did make such a big difference. That issue really permeated the entire proceeding.
Yes, it did, but your chart, which is also in your brief, sort of it's a double-edged sword, but it seems to me that there are a number of other points, too, in that when you read the ALJ's opinion as a whole, you can see that not only is he noting potentials of harm, but actual deaths, which are reflected on your chart, strike me as pretty clear evidence that something's going wrong. I mean, it's not like somebody's guessing whether anything is going to go wrong by the time R10 has died or by the time some of the other people have died, 126 or whoever it was, I forget all the numbers. But anyway, we could also talk about whether something like the Greenwich Colliery's rule applies to situations that are not entitlement programs. Of course, in the Department of Labor context in Greenwich Colliery, the court says the proponent of the entitlement has to prevail by a burden of proof when the evidence is in equipoise. The true doubt rule cannot be used. This is not an entitlement program. Fairfax had to qualify to get Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement. It fell out of compliance. Why isn't it properly the bearer of the burden of proof?
Well, that's their argument, but our point is that the APA is pretty clear that it is the proponent of the rule or order that bears the burden of proof. And in this situation, they're not challenging us on our entitlement to participate. This is a situation where they have said, you violated our regulation, and we are going to impose a $320,000 CMP on you. And it seems to me any plain reading of the APA, they are squarely the proponent of the rule in that situation.
So you envision, you're not persuaded by their thought that there's sort of two parts to their letter. One part says you're not going to get any more funding until we're satisfied that you're fully in compliance. The other part imposes the fine. You would agree that the no funding finding is one that Fairfax can properly bear the burden of proof on.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I would see. Surely at the beginning they have the burden of proof.
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So once you prove that you are a qualified nursing home, you have an entitlement for the rest of time to get that money?
Well, I think you were entitled to continue to operate until the HCFA proves that you've done something to violate the regulation.
But I'm trying to separate out the penalty side of the case, where I understand your argument to be that you're the proponent, or that, I'm sorry, the secretary is the proponent of the penalties versus the we want to get money side of
right.
the case, where it seems to me Fairfax is the one who's the proponent. They want the money from the federal government. It's up to them to show they're entitled to it.
Right.
And if the burden of proof is on the secretary for one of those and on the nursing home for the other in a single proceeding, I suppose in a hypothetical proceeding where the evidence is in equipoise, perhaps it would go one way on half of the case and one way on the other half of the case. That's not our case, of course, getting back to my first point. Seems to me the ALJ's findings are pretty overwhelming in terms of where he comes out on who prevailed.
Your Honor, if you read the decision, and I'm sure you've
read it very thoroughly.
But
like
the way I understand it is, if I could just refer to the chart, the ALJ essentially decided that, and if I could just briefly explain it, I'm sure you've read it.
I believe that you don't need to go through this chart. I mean,
No. You
have characterized this as somebody accidentally turning a ventilator off in December, whereas the ALJ focuses on failure to implement corrective procedures, failure to document things, failure to monitor, which lasts all the way through until April the 4th, when in the midst of this thorough annual survey, Fairfax finally puts into place procedures that will work. It's shocking that people are not documenting on charts, vital signs. Most doctors would say if it's not in the chart, it didn't happen.
Well, that's their position, but nursing homes are different from hospitals, Your Honor. We don't have the same charting requirements as hospitals do. And in the nursing home context, we essentially have to chart when there's a change in condition. And they have
How do you know if there's a change in condition if you haven't recorded anything earlier? People are just supposed to remember blood pressure and oxygen saturation rates?
That's right. When a nursing home receives a new resident, there's some intensive charting to establish a baseline during the first 72 hours. But after that, what happened in this situation is that Fairfax on its own implemented a more aggressive policy regarding charting than any regulation required during that February time frame, and then essentially the later deficiencies, which are not a repeat of the first deficiency regarding R10, those are different.
Well, the ALJ did not see them as different. You're fighting a factual battle here because the ALJ saw perhaps one of the most important things for R10 as being the failure to monitor. If somebody had gone back in right away, they would have noticed that the ventilator had been turned off. They would have noticed that R10 was in distress. Obviously, as a ventilator-dependent patient, you can't turn her ventilator off for half an hour and expect her to survive. So the ALJ sees a common theme of monitoring failure through this. And you have to explain why that's wrong.
I believe that the why it's wrong is the burden of proof was improperly placed on us, both from R10, the very first one, on up through the second. And that's how the ALJ was able to bridge that 70-day gap regarding where there was no deficient care whatsoever that was found. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, Your Honor.
Well, not really, because we don't need to go through every line of every patient, but the ALJ does give a very thorough discussion of the treatment of each of these residents of the home that were involved in these various things. So, for instance, with respect to R127, he says, I find the petitioner's failure to properly assess and monitor R127 during and after episodes of respiratory distress, as well as the failure to notify the treating physician regarding repeated episodes of respiratory distress, exposed the resident to risk of serious harm, injury, harm, impairment, or death. All through the opinion, I mean, there are similar findings with respect to all these people. So it's a monitoring problem that the ALJ is finding that's a common theme. And when you don't monitor, people die sometimes, which happened in a number of instances here.
That's true, Your Honor, but I think it needs to be remembered that these were do-not-resuscitate type of patients.
That doesn't mean you get away with not monitoring them. I think these are people especially in need of... What they want is the proper care. No one's expecting eternal life, you know, when they go into these nursing homes. We know these are, in fact, failing health people, but it doesn't mean you get to just wander by the room and not bother to check on them.
I think that the argument has been that they did not properly write it down and chart, and the presumption is that if it's not charted or written down, that it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that presumption, we believe, is an improper shift of the burden of proof. I'd also like to mention that with each of the later findings of deficiencies, as you know from the briefs, the ALJ applied an incorrect standard. He did not find, did not follow the standard for immediate jeopardy. He found mere risk or potential for harm, which equates with a lower level deficiency. Now that, with every one of his findings, except for R10, each of the findings later on in the 100-day period, he applied the incorrect standard. And that's the way that he was able to stretch it for 105 days of immediate jeopardy. But we've argued, and we respectfully submit, that the later deficiencies of lack of charting do not raise to the level of immediate jeopardy. There has to be some likelihood of harm or death, and there has to be an element of immediacy that did not exist with the later deficiencies.
You're not making this argument about R126, I assume.
Yes, I am. The actual finding.
Well, you're talking about the italicized bold face.
Correct.
Type, but I don't know why, as a court, we are supposed to disregard the three pages of explanation that follows that.
I'm not asking you to disregard it. I'm just suggesting that it's an indication that the opinion is unreliable.
But he says for R126, I find petitioner was woefully inadequate in the treatment and care of R126. Such conduct caused or was likely to cause serious injury, harm, impairment, or death. And in fact, that's what happened. He died.
He did, Your Honor, but he died 2 days after he was admitted to the nursing home in a vegetative state. He was a DNR resident. There were doctor's orders that were issued. The evidence was conflicting on whether they were carried out. But
and the ALJ finds they weren't. Finds no even circumstantial evidence, like orders from the lab, prescription forms filled out.
And again, that is reliance on the burden of proof. Who had the burden of proof to come up with that? And we suggest that it was Hicks's burden to provide evidence of noncompliance, consistent with Section 7C of the APA.
Okay.
We believe that the case, I see that I'm out of time, but I'd like to just mention one thing. The case of Greenwich, we believe, is dispositive in this instance. Hickman's never tried to distinguish that case. It rejected several of the same arguments that they've tried to make here. There is no statute that provides otherwise, and Hickman's clearly the proponent. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Yasuda.
May it please the court, Ted Yasuda for Health and Human Services. Judge Wood, I think you're right that if the burden of proof issue is reached by the court, it is subject to a harmless error analysis. And the ALJ and the Department of Appeals Board both stated when the burden of proof issue was raised, that it didn't operate to Fairfax's detriment because the evidence really was very strongly in favor of HHS. So this is not a case where the evidence was in equipoise where Hillman would make a difference.
But it is an important issue because I find it quite difficult to imagine why HCFA would not have the burden of proof to sustain a civil monetary penalty. Hillman isn't talking about monetary penalties. Greenwich Colliery seems to put the burden on the proponent. It's not that Fairfax is urging that somebody put a monetary penalty on itself. I could understand a different argument if you were just saying, if this case were about a cutoff of Medicaid and Medicare eligibility, where Fairfax arguably would be the proponent of saying we deserve it. But it seems to me the Secretary has really gone off in the wrong track to think that monetary penalties that can just do a prima facie case on shift the burden.
Well, if I could address that point, Your Honor, I think this case is somewhat unique among the cases that the petitioner and the government have cited where the government is assessing a penalty. But what makes it unique is at the same time the government is making massive ongoing Medicare and Medicaid payments. And I think what the court needs to focus on is what would the APA say if this were an initial application to participate in Medicare where the provider has to show I'm in substantial compliance, I deserve payment. Same thing if the government terminated. And what I'd like to suggest, Your Honor, is that when Congress authorized these CMP civil monetary penalty remedies in 1990, the legislative history is very clear that Congress is saying, well, Hickman's only remedy heretofore, really, was to kick the provider out of the program entirely and stop all funding, a rather draconian solution. And what Congress specifically found, and we tried to cite some of that in our brief, was that this was an ineffective regulatory mechanism because Hickman didn't want to exclude all payments to the provider, and so rarely terminated, and when it did, HICPA would rescind terminations. And Congress said this is not protecting people in nursing homes, so we're going to give you a panoply of less extreme remedies, and one of them was this daily CMP. And I think what HHS would suggest on the APA arguments is that really the CMP, when you view it in the total context, is a daily amount. It's really a take-back. The government at the same time, I mean, the government could have terminated for a fact, but didn't. The administrative record in this case, at AR 588, I think it's pretty graphic, that for 1996 and 1997, the government paid in Medicare and Medicaid in excess of $4 million to Fairfax. So when you look at this $300,000 fine for the period where there was a serious problem with the facility, you know, that's less than one-tenth of the total ongoing government payments.
But net out that kind of thing. It's still a penalty. And I don't see anything inconsistent about saying if the evidence isn't equipoise, you're entitled to cut off the funding, but you can't assess a penalty. You've got to prove by a preponderance that penalty-warranting behavior has happened.
Well, but the penalty is analytically like a reduction or partial reduction in payment. It's simply taken back. At the same time, the government is paying 10 times as much on an ongoing basis. And if, in fact, Your Honor believes that Fairfax would be the proponent of showing it's in substantial compliance when it attempts to stay in the program and demands payment in full, I think that allocation of the burden of proof makes sense when the remedy that HICMA is imposing is actually less severe to the facility than the termination remedy would have been. What Fairfax is essentially arguing is, I'm in substantial compliance, I meet all the statutory requirements of providing quality of care, government, you pay me in full. If under the APA, the proponent who wants a certification that they're in compliance is always viewed as a proponent of the order. The fact that the CMP is involved in this case really should not change that picture, because what HICPA is saying is, we think there are problems here. You have not fulfilled your obligations under the provider agreement and the statute to perform services according to the quality of care that you assured the government. So, analogous maybe to liquidated damages clause, HICPA is just saying we'll impose a daily take-back, which is only a fraction of the ongoing payments we make to you. And I think in that context, the allocation makes sense.
Well, Mr. Yasuda, in other situations, apparently involving civil monetary payments, you do place the burden on the government agency, as I understand it. Your opponent cited in its reply brief a section which I understand are not directly applicable in the situation we have before us, but yet they do involve civil monetary penalties, and there, by regulation, the Secretary has placed the burden on the agency. Why is that a different situation?
I think that we didn't have a chance to brief that, and I think the best explanation is contained. If the court would look at 57 Federal Register 3326, and this is the preamble that HHS issued when it promulgated those regulations. And what HHS explained at that time was that when the Inspector General imposes certain civil monetary penalties, the predicate offenses that trigger those civil monetary penalties are for conduct that's criminal or quasi-criminal in nature. The IG regs involve allegations of kickbacks or submission of false claims to the government. And what HHS explained at 57 Federal Register 3326 was that they went back and looked at the Senate report, and they said Congress is certainly indicating to us that because of the stigmatization and the gravity of these offenses, that these kinds of CMPs deserve special due process protection for the individuals affected. So for that reason, those IG regulations, the government does bear the burden of proof as to some of those. At the same time, though, the IG regulations at 1005.15C actually state that when the IG is imposing a remedy that doesn't involve this kind of knowing conduct, the burden of proof should be set by the ALJ, which is essentially what happened in the Hillman line of cases. So I think the IG cases, you know, are quite different. And the Medicare Act, you know, Congress sometimes borrows rather than enact new provisions. The Medicare statute governing nursing home CMPs borrowed the IG hearing provisions. But the Medicare statute at 1395I3H2B specifically excludes the portions of the IG statute, A and B, that those IG regulations were meant to implement. Now, the nursing home here did some bad things, and I suppose you could argue it has been stigmatized by the government to a certain degree, but this kind of offense is far different from an allegation that someone has knowingly submitted false claims to the government. So I think there is a distinction there.
Is there any regulation that requires that civil monetary penalties, the ones at issue in this case, be in any way key to the amount of payments given originally by HHS to the provider? Is there any correlation between the amount of payment that's made to the provider and the amount of the penalty?
I think HHS setting these CMPs is not an exact science, and it's somewhat discretionary. But the statute, HHS does have regulations that require the government to consider the financial circumstance of the facility and to make at least a prima facie showing that they can pay that. HHS's view is an affirmative defense. If the issue really is financial hardship,
that doesn't that doesn't create the relationship which you argued earlier between the amount given by HHS to the provider and the civil monetary penalties imposed on the provider. And you argued that was a de facto recoupment, but apparently there's no correlation between.
Well, there isn't an exact one, but the fact that the government is paying such substantial sums to the provider, you know, over 10 times the amount of the CMP, does suggest the provider can pay it back to us.
But are you implying that you couldn't
have... HHS does recover these through recoupment.
Are you implying that you couldn't have, at the same time, a CMP and a termination of participation in the program?
Yes, sometimes that actually does happen. The CMP...
The recoupment doesn't work there either, of course. There's no ongoing
recruitment may not work after the provider has been terminated, but I think that's one of the anomalies in this case. Does it make sense if on the termination side, the facility is the proponent of the order saying I meet the requirements, I should continue to receive payment, and suddenly on a different issue, a modest daily CMP that really analytically reduces the daily reimbursement, not in total but by a much lesser amount, that suddenly the burden of proof is different when
Why
the
is
issue
so
in the case,
difficult?
Substantial compliance, is the same.
But that happens in cases, you know, that burdens are sometimes moved, you know, from one side to the other.
Well, I think the key point, though, is the termination remedy is far more drastic, a far greater reduction in payment than this daily CMP, which represents a minor reduction in payment. And the provider in the CMP case is essentially saying, I'm in substantial compliance, pay me in full. And we think under Greenwich Calories, all the APA cases, someone who's arguing for that kind of position is the proponent of the order. And in fact, Greenwich Calories, you know, is a benefits case, and the Supreme Court indicated, well, under the Department of
Labor's
true doubt rule, if the evidence is an equipoise, the party asking for the government payment loses. That's essentially what Fairfax is doing here. It's saying there should be no CMP, no even modest reduction in the government's reimbursement, because I qualify, deserve payment in full. And we think
the government's position under Hillman... But you're defining the word order in a very strange way, right? Because you're opposing the order that the government wants to enter, you're now the proponent of the order?
Well, I think they're the proponent not of the fine, obviously, but they're the proponent of of their defense to the fine, which is that they're in substantial compliance. They're saying there's no basis for a reduction in Medicare reimbursement because I'm in substantial compliance. And I agree analytically, it is an unusual case where the government, as to the basis of the substantial compliance issue, we think the APA is clear, the provider should bear the burden. At the same time, the government is imposing a fine. That is an unusual circumstance, but we think when you parse it all out and understand the CMP is a lesser remedy than complete termination, the provider essentially is asking for the CMP to go away and is asking for payment in full, that Hillman is consistent with the APA.
Now, if you're wrong on burden of proof, your opponent has also argued that harmless error is not going to bail you out, at least on the immediate jeopardy point. Would you like to address that for a second?
Yes, Your Honor. I strongly disagree with Fairfax on that point. Here you had documented, the LGA found, two residents died because of a lack of adequate policies of care facilities, monitoring, which Your Honor mentioned, and two deaths within 3 months, and it conceded lack of policies until they attempted to get them going in March. I think any reasonable trier of fact under substantial evidence could review could conclude that there are serious problems and that individuals are being placed at risk. And I think, as Your Honor knows, CMS need not wait for people to die to make those kinds of findings. In fact, in this case, though, that potential harm was realized within two deaths within 3 months. And I think the evidence is quite clear that Fairfax was in immediate jeopardy. I mean, exposed its residents to immediate jeopardy during that period. The other thing I would suggest is that this court's old Ben Cole case, it is a pre-Grunge Collieries case, I think is the closest case on point. There, the government sought an order to close a mine. But this court didn't adopt those, well, the government must be the proponent. The court said, let's look at the history of this Mining Act. We think that the structure of the statute, the legislative history makes clear that it's really the mining operator that should demonstrate safety. So that's what we're arguing here. This court also looked, and I don't think Grunge Collieries precludes the federal courts from looking at traditional factors concerning allocation of burden proof. You know, this court said, well, when we're trying to figure out who the proponent of order is, who actually has the evidence in question? Who is best situated to make the showing as to mine safety? And they said, well, obviously the mine operator knows what it's doing. The government came forward with a prima facie case, but certainly the mine operator is best situated to proving the true facts. And we can't minimize the importance of the burden of proof issue. These elderly folks, you know, are cognitively impaired, frequently isolated. They can't speak up for themselves. CMS is not there to see the violations. We come in after the fact and can only reconstruct what happened based on review of records and interviews and so forth. And in that kind of environment, to shift the burden of proof entirely to CMS would endanger, we would submit, the rights of residents and their health and safety. And it isn't unfair to require the nursing home, which certainly knows what it did, what kind of care it was providing. It's a reasonable and fair rule to require them to come forward and say, government, you've got it wrong. We met substantial compliance. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd just like to address old Ben Cole for just a moment. In that case, it is clearly distinguishable because the court found that there was a section in the Longshore and Warehousing Act that did create an exemption to Section 7C. So their case is even weaker than in old Ben Cole because they have cited that no provision that arguably takes this case out of Section 7C. They argue that we are best situated to find to prove, you know, these various issues, but that's kind of a policy argument for Congress. Under the APA, Congress is the one who decides the burden of proof. They can't just interpret and conclude that as a whole, we think the burden of proof should be on Fairfax. That's an argument for Congress, because Congress decides in Section 7C, they decided that they bear the burden of proof in these types of cases. I would now like to address briefly his argument regarding the supposed less drastic remedy of CMPs. That's not the way that Congress saw it. Before 1987, Congress, there was this remedy of termination, but in 1987 they decided we're going to give it more teeth, we're going to give HCFA the opportunity to impose CMPs, and that's why they incorporated the separate section, 1320A7A, that already existed and allowed them to impose CMPs, but that provision requires
prior notice and a prior hearing. So before they can impose a CMP on us, they have to give us prior notice. That's different, and a hearing, which is different from some of the other less severe remedies. And so that's why, as Your Honor pointed out, there are regulations that apply, and those regulations put the burden of proof squarely on HCFA. And that's the same with, so the only regulations that are out there regarding CMP remedies put the burden of proof on HCFA. Thank you.
Well, our thanks to both Mr. Newfer and Mr. Yasuda for their fine argument today. This case will be taken under